This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Here's the scene, which you've experienced many times around the state. You're driving on a narrow two-lane road in rural Vermont, going the speed limit. Okay, 5 miles over the speed limit. Up ahead, you see a small group of cyclists on your side of the road. You can admit it. You start to feel a little angst. You might even be bothered that you have to go around them. So do you slow down, check the opposite lane so when you pass them, you give them wide berth? Do you focus a little more until you've gotten around the cyclists? Or do you keep cruising at the same speed? And if you're the cyclists, are you two or three abreast or riding in single file? The truth is, if we drive, cycle, or walk on Vermont roads, and that's most of us, we're all in this together, and we can all do a better job of interacting with one another. Here to explain how we can improve and what's being done in Vermont to make this all work better is Jason Van Dreisch, the Interim Executive Director of Local Motion, which is the statewide nonprofit advocate for walkable and bikeable communities, and John Kaplan, the Bicycle and Pedestrian Program Manager at VTrans. I want to welcome you both to VPR and Vermont Edition today.
Thank you. Thanks, Great, Rick, to be here.
All right, John Kaplan, first of all, do we have a problem with road safety in Vermont?
We do have bicycle crashes in Vermont. Of course, our goal would be to have no crashes. I would say there's always room for improvement as far as safety goes, and it's one of our agency's prime strategic goals is safety of all of the road users in the state.
Jason Van Dreisch, how do you see the picture?
They call people walking and biking vulnerable users for a reason. You're out there without the benefit of airbags and a steel structure around you. So we pay a lot of attention to safety because what we hear over and over from people all across the state is, I'd love to walk more and I'd especially love to bike more. I just don't feel safe. And there are plenty of people who are out there walking and biking who do feel safe. But the most important thing to make walking and biking an option for more folks is to improve safety.
John Kaplan, so not singling out any group, but what is the root of these collisions between cars and cyclists or pedestrians?
I'd say there's a shared responsibility out there, both for, you know, the motorists and bicyclists. When we've looked at the crash data for bicycle crashes, it's hard to pinpoint one particular behavior, either on the part of cyclists or motorists. There's a whole range of reasons. But I think you mentioned before, kind of on the driver's side, at least being aware of cyclists and giving them that extra space when a driver's going by them, that will create a safer condition. And then on the bicyclist side, doing things like wearing bright clothing, riding single file when you know that there's a car approaching, even though state law allows you to ride two abreast. The state law says you can ride two abreast unless you're impeding the normal flow of traffic. So it's just common courtesy for bicyclists to, get in single file when they know that there's a car approaching from the back.
Jason, do you see any root causes for why there are these collisions between cars and cyclists or driver or walkers?
The most important thing really is how our roads are designed. You see all over the country that places that make a concerted effort to have predictable, consistent, safe space for walking and biking see a decrease in crashes. And obviously there are issues related to how people walk, bike, and drive, but all of those issues become less significant if we design our roads for safe walking and biking as well as for safe driving.
Okay, so let's look at those roles and responsibilities. John, I'll start with you with pedestrians. I know you talked a little bit about the cyclists, but where should they be walking? What should they be wearing? How should they react to traffic?
Right. Well, it depends a little bit on the situation. So if it's a rural road, say, with no sidewalks, the state law is and really the best practice is for pedestrians to walk facing traffic. And if there is a sidewalk, of course, walking on the sidewalk is the safer option. I think Jason used the term vulnerable users, which is actually a term in state statute now. And the way I always look at it is both pedestrians and bicyclists, if you really have to bear a lot of that responsibility for yourself. And yes, motorists, you know, have to obey the law, of course, but in the event of a crash, it is going to be the bicyclist or the pedestrian who's going to sort of, you know, bear the brunt of that collision. So, you know, being aware of your surroundings, I see a lot of people who are walking with, you know, earbuds in, looking at their phones, and certainly, you know, distractions are a problem both for drivers and for pedestrians. And certainly we would discourage, you know, being distracted no matter how you're getting around.
We'll look at bikers next. And we heard from Peter, who says he's ridden across Iowa, Georgia, Florida, and he gives us these recommendations. Very bright flashing LEDs, red in the back, attached to the helmet if possible, a second red flasher on the back of the bike, a flashing white LED in front. Spend the extra money and get the brightest, strongest LEDs you can find. Second, he says, a reflective vest. You can probably get them at Home Depot or Lowe's. And also, be sure to wear a helmet every time. Adults can get traumatic brain injury too. And finally, he says, while LED lights and helmets can be a bit expensive, they are far, far cheaper than hospital stays, loss of work time, and rehabilitation. And Jason Van Dreisch, expand on what Peter has been telling us about, you know, how bikers should prepare and use the roads.
You know, he's right that all of those strategies are important. I use lights, I wear bright clothing, I always wear a helmet. But a lot of people don't want to have to look like a cross between a construction worker and a Christmas tree in order to be safe biking on the road. And I think we need to broaden the picture a little bit to how do we make it so that people feel safe and comfortable hopping on a bike or walking down the road without doing those kinds of intense preparations as if they're heading into a battle zone.
So what do you have to say, though, about what he has recommended? Is it worth the extra expense to have this equipment on?
You know, it depends on where you're riding. I think a helmet, absolutely. It's your insurance plan if everything else goes wrong. Lights, certainly, if you're riding at night. But if you're riding primarily on quieter rural roads or neighborhood streets or, you know, low-speed streets within a downtown, I think you can be a little more casual about it. It's clear that he's someone who's ridden long distances on higher speed roads. And yeah, if you're out on a state highway with trucks going by at 60 miles an hour, you want to be as visible as you can. For many folks who are riding in a calmer context, you can maybe dial it back a notch or two.
And John, how about drivers now? They are operating a vehicle that can be anywhere from 2,000 to 10,000 pounds. How can they better handle interactions with walkers and bike riders?
Well, I think it really just comes down to having a little bit of patience and, you know, taking the extra couple of seconds it might take to give bicyclists or pedestrians that extra space when they're going around. And certainly anything that's sort of harassing or driving closely to those vulnerable users is just going to make the situation worse. So, you know, it really just comes down to giving that extra space and being respectful of the other users on the road who do have a right to be there.
Now, I don't want to bog down with too many stats today, but this is one from VTrans that really made me take notice. And it says a pedestrian hit by a car traveling 40 miles per hour has an 85% chance of being killed. At 20 miles per hour, the chance drops to 20%. For the amount of time that you have to decelerate around pedestrians or cyclists and then accelerate again, we're honestly talking about adding, I mean, what, 20, 30 seconds to a trip? Jason, you know, how do you convince drivers that it is worth the time to just slow down before you come upon some bicyclists?
So I teach a course twice a year at the Vermont Police Academy for every new incoming police officer in Vermont, specifically about these issues. And I try to, you know, we give them a general overview of what the law is that they're expected to enforce related to walk and bike safety. But then we try to dial it down to where can you make the most difference as a police officer? And one of the things we always emphasize is really focus on speeding in low speed zones. Because the difference between, as you said, getting hit by a car if it's going 60 and if it's going 80, you're dead either way. But if you're in town and the speed limit is 25 and somebody's doing 40, that's a major difference. So enforcing speeding, particularly in villages, downtowns, other places where the speed limit is low and a lot of people are out walking and biking, that's absolutely crucial.
We also heard from Jay, who gave this advice. When a driver approaches a cyclist who's riding safely on the right side of the road, the tendency is for the driver to stare at the cyclist. Instead, the driver should scan the road ahead of the cyclists. If the driver sees a sewer grate, a pothole, fallen branch, a puddle, loose gravel, or other hazard, the driver should give the cyclist extra room. Better yet, let the cyclist maneuver around the hazard before passing the cyclist. Let's take a call from Daniel in Essex Junction. Daniel, thanks so much for calling Vermont Edition.
Hello. A few years ago, I was in a crosswalk with a green light, and somebody who was stopped for their red light, looking to the left to look for a break in oncoming traffic, slammed on the gas and hit me, and I got a ride to the hospital in an ambulance, a broken shoulder blade. I was wearing a helmet. Now, I discussed this with a friend of mine who does motorcycling, and he explained to me that his rule to avoid problems like this is pretend you're invisible. Do not assume you have been seen by a driver until and unless you have made eye contact with them. Now, this puts the responsibility squarely on the weaker party, the guy on the motorcycle or on a bicycle. But if that's what it takes to avoid a ride to the hospital or worse, it's worth doing. And this is not something that they mention at any of those safety-related courses that or short courses and topics that you get in grade school. And it really should be.
Jason Van Dreis, how do you react to that?
There's safety in numbers. And what I mean by that is that there's pretty clear evidence that has been amassed across the whole country that as you get more people walking and biking in a community, the relative risk for each person goes down. So the caller is absolutely right if you're the only one out there walking or biking. As walking and biking becomes something normal and common that you see all the time, all of us, when we're behind the wheel, start to notice it more and it becomes a regular part of the landscape. So absolutely, you need to act as if you're invisible if you're the only one biking. The bigger picture solution, and one of the things that Local Motion works for all over the state, is to change that picture by helping more people have the confidence to get out, walk, and bike, and go from being invisible to being a regular, expected part of what happens on our streets.
Well, John, in the V-Trans survey, you found that 25% of Vermonters live within 5 miles of work, yet the amount of people in Vermont who walk, cycle, or take public transit is a combined 9%. So how do we change that? How do we get people more comfortable to get out there and bike to work or walk to work?
Right, that's a good question. And I wanted to get back to your you made a comment about the impact of speed on crashes.
Yes.
And a lot of this, and actually the answer to this question too, has to do with design. There are a lot of things we can do with transportation system design that make it, create a safer condition for people to walk or bike. And there are things to do with design that sort of cue drivers to drive at a slower speed. So if you can picture kind of a village area where you have, you know, curbs and sidewalks and narrower travel lanes and maybe on-street parking, you know, that all that design sends a signal to the driver that this is a slower environment. This is an environment where I should expect bicyclists and pedestrians. And one of the positive changes that I've seen, I've been working in the bike and pedestrian field for about 25 years now. There are a lot more tools in the toolbox in terms of design now, from, you know, guidelines from around the country to coming down from the Federal Highway Administration. There is a lot more focus on this concept of complete streets, which is really fundamentally what that means is the streets should work for all of the users that are expected there. And it's sort of a context driven design philosophy.
We did hear from Kathy, who posted, after several fatalities 2 years ago, I feel that drivers are better now at slowing down and waiting until it's safe to pass. Many more drivers compared to several years ago will come up behind me, slow down, and wait until we're over the crest of a hill or around a blind curve to pass. Kathy also gives this advice to drivers, that they should think of cyclists as tractors, because when we see a tractor on the road, we definitely give it wide berth, go around it as far as possible. Jason Van Dreisch, there is a certain amount of fear yet associated with cycling in urban areas that keep people from riding to work. So how do we overcome that?
Well, I bike pretty much every day, almost year-round, unless it's really cold out. And the last time I was in a crash was well over a decade ago, and it resulted in a skinned knee. So I think people get a little too fixated on the danger part and lose sight of just how safe they actually can be biking on the road if they do a couple of basic things. One, know where you're going, know your route, so you know what to expect. And two, bike within your limits. You know what you're comfortable with and what you're not. You know, don't try to bike on Williston Road in South Burlington if what you're more comfortable with is, you know, a bike path or a quiet street. And as long as people stay within their limits, the chances of getting hurt are minuscule. And the benefits of biking in terms of not only health and well-being, but also just enjoying your day, vastly outweigh the risk.
We're discussing today how cars, cyclists, and pedestrians use the same roads differently, and how we can all work to make these streets much safer. Joining us with their perspectives are John Kaplan, the Bicycle and Pedestrian Program Manager at VTrans, and Jason Van Dreisch, the Interim Executive Director of Local Motion. Jason Van Dreisch, is there a need for better roads, for redesigning what we have here in Vermont?
So let's take apart the statistics real quick, because one of the things that I find really skews the picture is when people talk about how many people bike and walk to work. The number they're usually using is what's called the primary commute mode share. And that means when the census asks people, what's the main way you get to work? That's kind of like asking people, what's the main thing you eat? Oh, you eat pasta more than anything else? Well, you must not be interested in hamburgers then. A much more useful number is, what is your full range of how you get around? The primary commute percentage for bikes is 2%. When you ask people, did you bike into work in the last 12 months? It jumps to 11% of Vermonters. And when you ask people simply, do you bike frequently for any reason? We get up to 13%, nearly one in seven Vermonters. So I think the key thing to note here is that there are a lot of people in this state who are already biking. And the other thing is that the infrastructure doesn't serve them. When VTrans asked, what are you most dissatisfied with about Vermont's transportation system? Guess what the number one thing was? Availability of bike facilities. 42% of people are dissatisfied with that. Only 27% said they were dissatisfied with the condition of roads in general. So there's a big gap here between how many Vermonters are biking and how our roads are serving that need. So there's a bunch of strategies to fix that, and I know VTrans is working hard, as are a lot of communities, to address that. But we've got work to do.
Well, that leads us right to John Kaplan. What is VTrans doing, John?
Sure, I knew you'd be asking me this question. Well, a couple of things. A couple of years ago, we started what we're calling the On-Road Bike Plan, which is a kind of a long planning process where we've gotten input, looked at data, input from the public in terms of the state network of roadways that VTrans has responsibility for, and trying to see, you know, which of the state's roads are the most important for biking in terms of existing or potential use. And that is allowing us to prioritize resources on the roads that are the highest priority. There's currently a map, which was the result of the first phase, which breaks down the state network into sort of high, medium, and low priority. Not to say that we won't still do things on the low and medium priority roads, but you know, given limited resources, where we're going to really make the extra effort is on those high priority routes. And in terms of rural roads, I know that regularly we, with our paving projects, we try to add as much paved shoulder width as we can, with a goal of 3 or 4 feet on both sides of the road. And some of that we do through, you know, some very kind of low tech things, just by narrowing the travel lanes. We now, sort of our standard travel lane width is 11 feet where it used to be 12. So without even adding any pavement, we've added a foot to the shoulder that can be used by bicyclists or pedestrians. And in projects where it's more of an urban focus, we are looking at other things like actually marking bike lanes on the road with the symbols of a bicyclist and sometimes with some signs. And a recent project where we did something a little more innovative on the Berrymont Pillier Road last year, we had a paving project and we did what's called buffered bike lanes, where there's some extra painted space between where the cars are and where the bicyclists are. And really what nationally what bicyclists have been telling designers is that a lot of bicyclists just don't feel comfortable riding with only a paint stripe to separate them from moving traffic. And so having some kind of extra space, at least painted space, makes them feel a lot safer and actually does make them safer. We also did some things on that project with using green as a pavement marking to denote areas where bicyclists and cars might be having to merge with each other because of a turn lane or whatever. And we've gotten very positive feedback on the use of that green marking.
We also heard from Ian, who wrote, "I'm a daily bike commuter in downtown Burlington. I find the bike lanes to be really just lines of paint where society keeps its collection of broken glass and storm drains. They appear and disappear randomly and without warning. Can we look forward to more towns and cities developing bike and pedestrian-friendly infrastructure?" So Jason Van Dreisch, we heard from someone riding in Montpelier, in Burlington. What can we do to address these things?
Yeah, there's no way around the fact that if we want to make streets safe and welcoming for people walking and biking, it's an investment. The good part is it's a pretty modest investment compared to most things that we spend money on as a state, and it's something that a lot of people want. So some of the strategies that work well are, I know in Burlington, for instance, they're starting to experiment with some alternatives to paint that will last for 3 to 5 years instead of half a year like a typical paint stripe will now. With regard to the fact that a stripe often just doesn't feel like enough to give you protection as a bicyclist, Burlington is starting to experiment this year with protected bike lanes, where you actually have a barrier between the bike lane and the car lane. And that's going to make a huge difference. And I think most importantly, a really exciting new approach in Burlington that's rolling out this year is something they're calling quick builds for safer streets. And what they mean by that is using paint, using these bike lane protectors, using flexible plastic posts that get bolted down to the pavement, things that can be installed fast without a big construction project and lots of engineering to significantly change conditions on the ground. And the best part is that those same techniques aren't just useful in Burlington. They're really useful at any scale in any community because they're low cost, they're fast, and they work.
Well, we are seeing that in some cities like, I think, Montreal and Portland, Oregon, and Calgary. Are we learning from bigger cities on what to do here in Vermont?
Very much so, and there's a translation process of how you figure out what is going to work on narrower streets, narrower roads. But the fundamentals really are the same, and I think the most important thing is being willing to experiment and to do things quickly and see what works rather than doing everything via big construction projects that takes 5-8 years if it ever happens at all.
Now, John, you mentioned using green paint. We heard from Will. Here's a little feedback directly to you. He says, "Blaze green is not effective here in the summer on wooded roads. It's practically camo. You see it all the time. I suggest blaze pink." What do you think of that?
It's an interesting idea. Unfortunately, we're somewhat bound by some national standards in terms of what we can use for, pavement markings. You know, that's why the center line is always yellow and the edge lines are white and so forth. So, there is some room for experimenting. If we wanted to experiment with something, the state could, we can request an experiment. We are always looking for, new ideas and things that are kind of, out of the box thinking.
Now, John, none of us want to admit that we're distracted drivers. I'm not. until I can't find like the exact CD I want to pop in next, or I drop something on the floor. So what can you say to me that will get me to stop searching for that missing something while I'm driving so that I'll be safer on the roads for those I'm sharing it with?
Oh, boy. I'm not like a safety expert as far as, encouraging distracted driving. You know, I will say, though, that, if you think about the lives that you potentially could impact, I don't have the exact numbers, but, at 40 miles an hour, the number of feet that a car travels in just a couple of seconds is pretty scary when you see that. You know, it's hundreds of feet, and lots of things can happen in that short second that you're searching for the CD. So really, we all need to be focusing on, the task at hand, which is driving, and realize that, that heavy piece of equipment can be dangerous if something happens.
Let me just put a little bit more of a point on that. Picture your own child or your grandchild on a bike ahead of you on the road and think about what you would do.
That's an excellent point. Let's talk to Karen, who's calling us from Milton today. Karen, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Yes, hi. We live in a rural area, country road. It's gorgeous out here. My husband and I walk to a nearby beaver pond almost every night. We love it. And I feel as though we do everything right. We both wear reflective orange vests. We walk single file. We get off the road as much as possible. When a car is coming, we walk facing traffic. So we feel like we're doing everything well, but what's disconcerting is sometimes just the sheer speed on a country road that people will drive. And it's just very hard to be, walking toward a car and it's not moving over and it's blazing past. It's very, very disconcerting. So I'm glad to hear that, you're mentioning the importance of paying attention, drivers cooperating with walkers, because then we would feel a whole lot safer.
Thanks, Karen, for that comment. We also heard from Erica, who says, I'm just wondering why bicyclists don't ride or can't ride facing traffic like walkers. Why is that? Why is there the difference between the two?
Very simple. A bicyclist will be traveling at 12, 15, sometimes even 20 miles an hour. And if you add the speed of the bicyclist to the speed of the car, it could mean the difference between a crash that somebody walks away from and a crash that is much more consequential.
Now, we did hear from Steve, who wrote a while back to remind us why we love being on bikes in the first place. He says, Vermont is home to some fantastic rail trails that I recommend everyone plan a day to go and enjoy. My wife, daughter, and I frequently take trips to ride on the Missisquoi Rail Trail between Richford and St. Albans. We're also in love with the open sections of the Lamoille Valley Rail, which we continue to support in the hope that soon it will be completed and pass through our own town of Hardwick. So, John, are there any more plans to expand trails like this that would allow people the opportunity to cycle and to walk but to be off the roads?
Like the caller mentioned, there is the Lamoille Valley Rail Trail, which actually VAST, the snowmobile organization, is working to get that project completed, which will be a great asset for the state. It'll be, I think, roughly 90 miles across the northern part of the state. And we're assisting with that project as much as we can. There's also a rail trail, which is probably the least known in the state, called the Delaware and Hudson Rail Trail down in the southwest part of the state. We actually have a project where we're going to be putting a new aggregate surface on that to make it more usable. And then there's so many projects across the state that are happening at the community level. VTrans has a grant program that we try to help communities with those types of projects, and there's a lot of that going on.
That sounds great. Very encouraging. John Kaplan is the Bicycle and Pedestrian Program Manager at VTrans. Jason Van Dreisch is the Interim Executive Director of Local Motion, which is the statewide nonprofit advocate for walkable and bikeable communities. We've provided information on road safety from both organizations on our website. You can go to vpr.net/Vermont Edition. And I want to thank you both for coming in today.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
Thank you.